This Second Childhood production is for the Killer Bees podcast and I mix what I like .org. Joining us now is Dr. Gay Teresa Johnson, who is a professor of history, Chicano, and African studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and is here to talk with us about her book, Spaces of Conflict, Sounds of Solidarity, Music, Race, and Spatial Enlightenment in Los Angeles, which is a history of cultural politics and civil rights struggles of Black and brown people in Los Angeles. Thank you, Dr. Johnson, for joining us. Good morning.
Good morning, and thank you so much for having me. I've been very excited to be part of this show.
So tell us first about your book. You know, tell us what you mean to convey in this book, what it's generally about, and then, of course, specifically, what you mean by this phrase, spatial enlightenment.
You know, the thing that I've been thinking about for a very long time, and in part because I am myself an embodied biracial Black and Mexican person, but also because I have for many, many years and even grew up around, I've been involved in social justice struggles. I've been frustrated with the ways that we enter into a very comparative paradigm about how we struggle together and what our histories are about. So in a way, spatial entitlement, which I'll get to in a second, is just a lens for me to study. And the same thing with looking at Black and brown struggles is just a lens for us to think about a broader theory of social movements and social struggle and trying to reach some kind of level of justice in our communities. And so I think what I was frustrated with gave rise to something that allowed me to think about, based on the history that I both observed and been part of, gave rise to the ability to think about a way that we can talk to each other in a relational way, that we could think about our histories in a relational way rather than one that's merely competitive and comparative, the one that separates us and asks us to compare notes. Instead, think about where are the places and the spaces and the sounds where we have interacted. And the major narrative that I was writing against is this notion that is really popular nowadays, and that is that Black and brown people have nothing but a history of antagonism towards one another, and that even now things are getting worse. So there are so many discussions about the ways that Black and brown people are violent towards each other in low-income communities, but also in prison. This is the dominant discourse about Black-brown relationships. We have, over the course of decades now, a lot of scholarly discussion, too, about the antagonism. And what I didn't see, and what I think is starting to at least gain some kind of momentum, is a discussion of how we do have a history together, of struggling together, of identifying each other as the mutual beneficiaries of our own history and strategy. And so this is what I was most concerned with as I started to write the book. But then I started to think about space, because space is so important for all aggrieved communities. Part of it in the late 20th century, early 21st century, is about disinvestment in our community in all kinds of ways by the structures of our society, the ways in which we are as low-income and aggrieved minority communities, as the way that we're shut out of opportunities in modes and with methods that render us permanently exiled from the opportunities that assure collective success. So as I thought about how we struggle against that, and also the particular modes of neoliberalism, the particular modes of oppression that have been deployed to render us in many ways disabled from and exiled from these opportunities, I started to think about how space has been used against us, but also how we've used it creatively to get back some of the things that have been taken from us, and also to assert a kind of collective and political identity that says, look, you may take away the community. You may, through eminent domain, destroy the communities that we have drawn strength from, that we've drawn important notions of personal and collective identity. But we are going to announce ourselves on the landscape of this new this new vision that you may have, of whether it's of Los Angeles or Detroit or New York, in a way that you may never imagine, and in a way that validates us on a daily basis and tells us again who we are and who we are to each other.
Thank you for that. And of course, thank you for correcting what I don't know what I was channeling there subconsciously, but I keep referring to your book. I keep referring to that concept of spatial enlightenment, when of course you use it
as
spatial entitlement.
It's like, you know, it's like communism and socialism. It's like entitlement on the way to enlightenment. So I'm down with it all the way.
Well, that's good. I'm glad. I like that. I mean to ask you in a few minutes about your conclusion and your quotes that begin with Marx and Marley, which I appreciate as well. But one of the things I definitely, so first of all, you've already covered in many ways, one of the things I definitely wanted to ask you about. I mean, this idea that we almost only hear nowadays of the horror stories in terms of Black and brown relationships. And for even those of us within what is often called the hip hop community, where we were sort of acculturated in an environment where Black and brown were almost synonymous in many ways, and Black took on a very literal and open Pan-African character, obviously in the best sense of all of these interactions, you know. So I'm glad you dealt with that. But one of the things in terms of the identities of all of these world majority communities is something that you talk about at the beginning of your book, where you say, quote, "The United States has historically defined its citizens not as much by who they are, but rather who they are not. At both federal and local levels, a desire by whites to sustain racial and class privilege has been the driving force behind legislation authored to exclude people based on race, gender, origin, and legal status," end quote. And this very much informs the way you approach all of this. So I wondered if you could say maybe a word or two more about that, but then maybe talk a little bit about some of these histories you recount about how Black people have felt in Latin America, or the relationship, as you described, between Cesar Chavez and Bobby Seale. And I might want to ask you about Obama's, you know, appropriation of the "Si se puede" phrase.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love
to talk about that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you delve even more specifically into the experiences of Black and brown women in all of this. So I'd like you to expand on any or all of those ideas. Again, this pan world people of color identity that's imposed by the identity standards of the United States and the West, and then some of the wonderful histories that you bring back to life for us a little bit.
The thing about this book is that because it's about Los Angeles, we're talking about very specific identities, but because in a way, you know, here being Black and or brown is very different from being Black and or brown in New York, for example, or in Florida, or in Panama. So in some ways, you know, the book reflects the way that we, you know, migration patterns and demographics, et cetera, but also trying to acknowledge through a relational study of sound and identity, how these identities, while often sort of imposed upon us as separate, also are so fluid that they have, by necessity, often had to become conflated or used in different ways. I mean, I'm reminded of the ways that many musicians at the turn of the 19th or 20th century, depending on where they were, New Orleans, Texas, wherever they were touring, sometimes they were Black, sometimes they were Mexican, sometimes they were white. It just depended on what was allowed based on these convoluted categories of citizenship and race that the United States was constantly changing. So you could be white, you could be Mexican in, you know, 1 year, and then the next year you're white. And so this is, of course, many people have talked about what a contested terrain this is. But, you know, for those of us who are looking at this as a political history, as a radical history of struggle, we have to think about the choices that people have made in various situations, and in ways that have allowed them to get the things that they want, whether, you know, independently or collectively. So, I mean, when I'm talking about especially in the very beginning of the book, the way that citizenship has been defined for us, part of what I'm talking about is a systemic denial of the 14th Amendment for so many of us, and not just in terms of the sort of citizenship that we see on paper, but in fact, the citizenship that is daily denied to us even today. And that's something that is persistent, and it's something that carries through this narrative. I mean, I feel like, you know, even though I start in the 1940s, the same problems and the same methods of exclusion, even though racism has changed and many, many modes of change of that exclusion, nonetheless, the aims are the same, which is to create a permanently disenfranchised class of people. And why Black and brown people, you know, it's been determined in very sophisticated ways by people who don't necessarily end up in the history books or in the sociology books, why this has happened in terms of labor and political enlightenment. And so that I guess is part of what I would say on that. I'm happy to expand. But in terms of talking about women, this is one of the major gaps in the literature on Los Angeles and really on lots of books on political struggle, especially ones like this, where we're looking at particular kinds of demographics, racial demographics. If people don't talk about the ways that women have driven this kind of history of mutual affiliation and even sometimes antagonism, but more often than not, it's women who identify the struggles that are mutually relevant to each other. This is why in the first chapter, I chose to talk about Charlotta Bass and Luisa Moreno together. And a lot of folks had in sort of the first review of you know, the early chapters of the book, people were saying, well, but you know, you have no proof that these two women ever dialogued or worked together. And I thought, that's really interesting, because in a way it's kind of impossible that they wouldn't have, because they're on the same committee at the same time, they're organizing at the same time. But, you know, anyway, as time went on, I thought, you know, part of it, even though there is no mention of these women working together, part of what's important is to understand how it is that when we consider these women together, in many ways we get a more powerful and radical history than when we consider them apart. Because we're not used to, whether theoretically or in terms of just our collective memory on social justice struggle, thinking about our communities together, which redefines the categories of citizenship that are imposed upon us. And so, I mean, this is just, something like that is rather experimental, but it's at the same time meant to be encouraging for us to think about ourselves and each other differently.
You know, one of the things that I really appreciated, again, obviously because of some of the hip-hop context in which I'm interpreting this, and that you bring out directly in this work, extending from something we've already covered a little bit here, that you say here at one point, you start to bring in the issue of, well, first of all, you mentioned the semi-colonial status of Black and brown people, which I find always to be extremely important in the way people interpret the conditions of these communities. But then you say something, while in the record of Black and brown interactions, there have been devastating examples of intergroup tension, there are far more examples of mutually meaningful Black-brown anti-racism struggles and radical creative affiliations, end quote. Mm-hmm. And then you go on to talk about, you interweave into this a discussion of turntablism and beat juggling, which when I read this, I was like, man, that is fantastic. So you say later, you know, a turntablist has to know records, but also has to have a mental archive, not only of songs, but also of phrases, tempos, lyrics, and instrumentation. Beat juggling must anticipate audiences' collective memories and produce an appealing textual combination of those memories. So I wanted you to talk a little bit about how you used this as, you know, this device of the beat juggling and turntablism to explain what you talk about here and center here the importance of cultural and historical memory.
I'm so glad you like that, because I wrote that actually a long time ago, before the book was really even in its process of being written. And I could never really get folks on board with that analogy found in the various discussions that I would have using that as a rubric. But I always thought that people who knew hip-hop and who know the communities that it comes from and the struggles that it has gone through as a form would get it as a model for what we have to do and the kind of presence of mind that we have to have. So, I mean, part of what I'm talking about there is kind of the common sense that we have when we listen to, say, we go to a show, a hip hop show, or we're involved in a protest, and the music and the sounds and the smells of our communities. Many times, what the people who are chosen to be vendors or speakers or performers, those folks have to make sense to the folks that are there struggling or who are there making community. So this is why the band War is so important, I think, because War, as I explained in the book, is a group that starts out, at least in one iteration, is Senor Sol, and they are these brothers wearing, you know, sarapes and sombreros, and, you know, they grew up in South Central listening to mariachi music. So somehow, of course, all of this is going to be interpolated into the kind of stuff that they're going to produce. But the funny thing about it, and I mean, it's funny, ha-ha, but it's also kind of like funny, powerful, is that you can get these brothers on an album cover with these outfits on, and really, you know, you can go to a show and they're really jamming and it's incredible, and then eventually they turn into War. And War is not really, it's not a group that we would say has transformed us with their political directives. But what they have done is radicalized us in many ways to understanding and identifying each other as the mutual beneficiaries of our own struggle. Because when you hear War, you hear a little bit of everything that represents South LA, and even, you know, in the echoes of other groups too, that makes sense, even maybe more specifically to these groups that I've identified as Mexican and or Black. So, you know, there's something in here that is awakening our senses, but also encouraging us to understand, you know, here are some pastimes that they identify that we all have taken part in, and these have been radical and important struggles. Let's think about, for example, their song Lowrider. Lowrider is again, it's not, you know, the politically transformative song, but it identifies something that took place in part as a result of the disenfranchisement and the exclusion of Black and brown people in the post-war era in Los Angeles. This is a phenomenon, this pastime of low riding comes out of the transference of skills learned in wartime industries, the transference to decorating and maintaining cars. But then it also is about, I think more specifically to the book, is about the assertion of one's right to be in a space. Now, lots of people would cruise on Whittier Boulevard, and the reason why is because it was uniquely tailored to show off the cars, and the lights are shining onto the street, and it's a wide street, you know, it's a place where people can congregate. But that area was one in which, through urban renewal, brown people were removed from that area, and it became a place where business was encouraged, and where, in a way, the vision of a future Los Angeles was realized. And so as they were excluded from these places, nonetheless, it's like you can't live there anymore, you're not welcome here anymore, and it's hard for you to get a job over here. But you know what? Every Friday, every Saturday, we're going to be there deep. We're going to be there. We're going to be throwing music out of our car windows. We're going to be there in the shiniest, most incredible cars that you can imagine, and we're going to make this a place that is really now synonymous with our community, even if you have systematically excluded us from property ownership and being able to claim this as our community. Now, I think what's really important for me to say here is that in terms of asset ownership and that kind of thing, you can't replace the power of owning property in this community, in this society, with the celebration, the mere celebration of the cultural forms that unite us. The power isn't the same in this society. But sometimes that's all you have, especially if you are a community like Chavez Ravine, which is, I mean, it was such a terrible and tragic history that has only kind of recently been uncovered again and by mainstream scholarship, but has always been known by our communities, and because it wasn't only, it was predominantly a brown community, but it was also, there were also black people that lived there too. And so what does it mean when you have people who are still alive? I just heard from somebody a couple of months ago who was pictured by the LA Times being dragged out of her house by the police. One of the last people to be standing there in Chavez Ravine before it was destroyed as part of eminent domain. And when it takes at least three generations to regain the assets that the community has lost, and many of them never regain these assets. So they own homes, they do these things that are supposed to assure them entry into the American dream, and then it is just taken away from them carte blanche. And so how do you then say, I'm still important, I'm beautiful, I matter? How do you say that not just to the surrounding United States, but also to yourself and to the populations across the globe that are watching you? You do it sometimes through popular culture. The power that popular cultural forms, like songs, like the kinds of things that bring us in the community together, have for allowing us, for joining us, for inspiring us to identify each other and each other's community as the source from which we draw strength and power to fight these struggles every day is something that's often overlooked and totally underestimated.
Unfortunately, we have to wrap up here in a moment, but there was something sort of in line with extending, I think, from where you were just wrapping up there. And I know that somewhere, probably you or somewhere, somebody could deal with this better than I'm about to. But I couldn't help thinking, you know, because I didn't want to leave without asking you to comment on what has always bothered me about the political rise of Barack Obama and the use of Yes, We Can, knowing full well that he got that from Si Se Puede and Cesar Chavez and a very different kind of political movement. But there's something about this overlay of sort of a fraudulent representation of something else in that phrase. And then, you know, with so many people, particularly, you know, some of the students that probably show up in our classrooms, where much of what they know of the history of this interaction of black and brown histories and struggles comes from a pop culture. And then, you know, so some I'm thinking might know more about these interactions in the misused Yes We Can, or also I was just thinking of Obama and Jay-Z's issue over Cuba. You know, like this is the way that Latin America and Black American struggles seem to come into so many people's consciousness. Mm-hmm. And I know that this is intentional, and I think your book does a lot to deal with that. So maybe, you know, in some kind of response to that jumbled mess of a question,
that makes sense.
You could form some concluding comments for us, because unfortunately we're running out of time.
Sure. Absolutely. I mean, this is the thing we have to be clear about is what history we have together without allowing people to determine for us what that history is. And this is the kind of thing that happens when Si Se Puede gets appropriated, does not remember for us the struggle people are studying in fields from the kind of protest. People don't understand what it means for Cesar Chavez to have gone on a hunger strike, to have sacrificed his body, his mind, his spirit for the movement. But all of those people who watch from around the world, the radical politics of day in, day out struggle, people don't understand what it meant for Dolores Huerta to be going through the field in the heat, trying to get people to sign up to be part of the movement. And this was the kind of protracted struggle that folks just today are not allowed to get a handle on. And so when you appropriate that kind of language to then categorize and characterize a movement that is scrubbed up and clean from all of that kind of necessary strife and violent battle with white supremacy, violent battle. And this is the thing, if you really know what CSEPUEDA is about, it's not just about yes, we can, it's about yes, we will, and we will not be stopped. Now, that's not the same message that was being thrown out there. It was a safe, very safe message that the Obama campaign was kind of banking on, that people would misremember about CSEPUEDA. I think in many ways, they felt, this is my guess, that part of the Chicano movement was obscure enough that they could capitalize on that phrase. I think that when you look at the particular demographic that describes that, it's a docile enough one that it could appeal broadly to lots of different people. And let's face it, that even if you're using that today, especially if you're using that today, it's really a sort of utmost disrespect to the kind of treatment that undocumented immigrants working in the field are subjected to today. And I would say, just to your point, and I know it's time to wrap up, but there's no way you can decouple the ways that undocumented immigrants are being treated, and also documented folks too, who are victims of the racial profiling that is part of Homeland Security's immigration legislation. You can't decouple that from the racial profiling that Black people are constantly subjected to. The Trayvon Martin stuff is very, very much connected to what's going on with ICE and Homeland Security and ESCOM. There is no way to take them apart, because the prison industrial complex and the systematic destabilization of our communities in very similar ways, but in different categories, is often so well separated by the dominant discourse that we have forgotten how much, not only that we into each other and how much that we can help each other and be a part of all this struggle together, but also how to analyze and to organically connect the ways that these things are similarly taking us out, and not just disenfranchising us, but neutralizing us completely as any kind of full participant in the things that make us successful and whole as human beings.
Dr. Gay Teresa Johnson, thank you very much for joining us. The book, again, is Spaces of Conflict, Sounds of Solidarity, Music, Race, and Spatial Entitlement in Los Angeles. Thank you very much again for your time. We really appreciate the work and the discussion.
Thank you, and I really appreciate your work. Thank you so much.
This Second Childhood production is for the Killer Bees podcast, and I mix what I like. .org